This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and to expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. My guest this week is Brendan O'Neill, the editor of Spiked Online, which I think is one of the most interesting political magazines in the world. Brendan thinks there is a crisis of democracy right now, and I think that democracy is always a crisis. This is my interview with Brendan O'Neill. So welcome to the Unregistered Podcast. I'm joined this week by Brendan O'Neill from, are you in London?
I'm in London, yes.
That's your regular hangout? That's where you are based, as we like to say these days?
This is my home, born and bred.
Born and bred in London, yeah. I've been meaning to have you on the show for a long, long time. I think we, in fact, invited you quite a while ago. But of course, geographical constraints when the show was an in-person show made that impossible. But now, you know, the virus has opened up new possibilities. The quarantine has opened up new possibilities. We should celebrate, right, Brendan?
Absolutely. I suppose there are some upsides to the virus. And one is that I think people are connecting more than they otherwise did, certainly online. It's opened up a whole new world of virtual conversation, which is quite healthy, I think, in order to get through the lockdown, which is proving quite difficult for some people.
Yeah, you are not a fan of the lockdown, not a fan of the government actions, both in the UK and the US at all, correct?
Yeah, I'm skeptical. I remain to be convinced that this is the right course of action. But I'm kind of holding my cards close to my chest because I don't think anyone really knows what is the right course of action. And I don't think we will know for a long time, maybe even years, when we can analyze exactly what the impact was of the various decisions that we took. But I'm skeptical, firstly, because it represents a complete collapse of freedom and democracy, and secondly, because there is emerging evidence that the lockdown is bad for health as well, and may even be contributing to excess deaths. So we should at least be made uncomfortable by the lockdown, even if we adhere to its rules for the time.
Yes. You recently had Peter Hitchens on your podcast, and he has just nothing but scathing denunciations of government actions, the lockdown in general, as an idea even. Am I right?
Yeah, he's probably the most scathing voice in the UK. There are some scathing voices in the US as well. Heather MacDonald is a pretty prominent critic off the lockdown. I share their concerns. I absolutely share their concerns. I'm very uncomfortable with what's happened in our societies. The thing that makes me most uncomfortable is the relative ease with which our governments were able to remove pretty much every freedom that we enjoy. So in the UK, for example, they passed something called the Coronavirus Bill, which is the most draconian piece of legislation ever passed in peacetime in this country. It really is an extraordinary piece of legislation which has robbed me and everyone else in this country of our most fundamental freedoms. And then Parliament, once it passed the bill, disbanded itself. So we also no longer have political representation. So this is an incredibly worrying situation. Me and millions of others no longer have democratic representation or the fundamental freedom to express ourselves or to protest or to go out in public. So I at least would like to see people, even if they accept the lockdown, I would like them to be bristling a bit more and to be asking questions. And it's the lack of questions that I think is quite worrying.
What are the provisions in this bill? I don't know about this bill.
Numerous provisions. It's fundamentally, it's a public health emergency piece of legislation. So it gives the police and the state extraordinary powers over the citizens. For example, the police can arrest you if they suspect you have coronavirus and if they suspect you need to be taken away from the public sphere. One example of something else in the bill, in this country we have a thing called sectioning. You can section a mentally ill person. That means you can force a mentally ill person to go to hospital and to stay locked up against his consent. Usually you need two doctors to organise the sectioning of a mentally ill person. Now, because of this bill, you only need one doctor. Also, it forbids any form of political protest, any form of political gathering. It forbids industrial action. So, and it makes provisions for the prevention of the distribution of mythical information about the disease and so on. So it's quite censorious too. So it is a pretty thorough assault, even on the right to go outside fundamentally. You know, if you go outside now and a policeman suspects you have the virus, you could be arrested. That's pretty severe. So it really is an all-out assault on fundamental freedoms. Now, most people in this country consent to the idea that this is a necessary temporary measure. Maybe that's correct. But we absolutely have to ensure that it doesn't stay on the statute books for 1 minute longer than necessary, because we know from the history of things like the Patriot Act in the US and other forms of anti-terror legislation in the UK, that emergency situations have a horrible habit of staying on the statute books longer than necessary. And I'm worried that some of these provisions might stay around.
That's a remarkable set of restrictions and repressions, I would say, on freedom in the UK I was unaware of. And it would be, I think, perhaps if Obama was president, they could pass it here. But under Trump, I think we're inoculated from any such thing because there'd be so much resistance to anything Trump does that it wouldn't pass. But I think American culture wouldn't allow that except in actual wartime. I mean, this is beginning to look a bit like a wartime political economy here and certainly in Europe. But I don't think right now American people, generally speaking, although there have certainly been many, especially intellectuals, who have been calling for a wartime economy, you know, straight up, and martial law, basically, and people wearing badges declaring whether they are positive or negative for the virus. But, you know, overall, I don't think, and this is why, you know, all the mayors and governors have basically refused to enforce the law for the most part. There have been a few examples, some of them quite egregious, but in large part, the police are not doing anything to enforce it over here. So that tells me that, you know, A, the government is afraid to attempt to enforce these laws on Americans, and B, that they don't need to because Americans are doing it themselves. They're self-quarantining themselves in large part. But how do you explain, and maybe, you know, this is interesting because I think it's going to lead directly into an issue that you've talked a lot about, which is Brexit, right? It's about the political culture of Britain these days, right? Or maybe for more than a few days, maybe it's been, you're sort of one of the experts on this, you know, when did this happen? Or has this been part of British political culture for decades? Or, I mean, I lived in London in 1986 and 1987. It's been a long time since I've actually been on the ground there. I've just observed politics from afar. But, you know, there is certainly across European politics, including British politics, you know, more collectivism, I'd say, than here, right? This is sort of well known. I mean, you describe yourself as a libertarian of a sort, of a particular kind, and libertarians are even more scarce in the UK than they are in the US. Far more. But what is this sort of
I mean, is this sort of a long-standing part of British culture, or is this sort of a new phenomenon you're observing that would allow such a thing?
Well, you know, I call myself a left libertarian, so which is almost non-existent in the UK. There are left libertarians in the US who I admire enormously, but it's a very rare breed in the United Kingdom. But I think the history of the UK, particularly the history of England, is in fact just one long struggle for more and more freedom. You know, this country in its modern sense is built upon the struggle for freedom, most notably press freedom, and then the freedom of speech, and then the right to vote, and then the right to report on what happens in Parliament. I mean, all these struggles which take place in the 1600s through to the 1900s have been incredibly important and have played an enormous role in shaping attitudes in America and in France and in other countries too. So England has played a really central role to the development of the idea of freedom. Sure. You know, from John Milton to John Stuart Mill, we have some really great thinkers here who have defined to a large extent what it means to be a free-thinking, free-speaking citizen. So we have that really good tradition, and that tradition has stood us in good stead. And for the most part, English people want their freedom and they want the liberty to be left alone by the state. You know, it's not a coincidence that in this country that the phrase an English man's home is his castle is a really important phrase. People think that means English people are house proud, but it doesn't mean that. What it means is the state should treat an English man's home as if it were a castle, i.e. Don't enter. Don't go into these people's homes. Leave them alone. Let them live and speak and choose freely in the way that they want to. So that's written into our DNA. And I think it's so we're one of those countries, and most countries are probably like this, where throughout history we value freedom, but there come moments when we let it go, or we let it slip away, or we don't cleave to it as tightly as we ought to. And I think we're currently living through one of those moments. But what's very interesting about what's happening now in the UK is that you say that the police in the US aren't really enforcing the law. It's the opposite here. The police have overreacted enormously to people going outside. They're patrolling parks, they're sending people home for sitting under a tree or sitting on a park bench. They're really being incredibly heavy-handed, and that is winding people up, that is making people annoyed. So the police behaviour is reminding people, I think, of just how illiberal the current moment is. So that discomfort is still there, and it bubbles to the surface every now and then. But as I say, the thing that worries me is that I think we've accepted this too easily, and I would like to see more kickback, or at least a plan, a longer-term plan, to ensure that all of this stuff is rescinded as soon as possible.
Yeah, I guess I'm a little confused with your analysis. I mean, you're saying that freedom is in the DNA of the British. First of all, I was going to say, it may be written in the DNA culturally, but it is not written into a constitution, right? As it is here, we have a Bill of Rights here in our constitution, which have many of the rights and the freedoms that you enumerated there, but they're written out in our constitution, as we well know, and you don't have that. But you know, you make it sound as if that, well, you say being in the DNA, the cultural DNA, I'm assuming you mean, of Britain and especially England, should tell me it would be a society that would not allow such measures. But it sounds to me the way you're describing the British people is that they're acting pretty much like sheep in response to this complete crackdown on their freedoms. So what is the explanation for that? Why do you think the British people, generally speaking, are allowing such things?
I don't think they're acting like sheep, but I do think but there is a broad acceptance of the necessity of this stuff, which makes me a little uncomfortable. But I think that the sheep-like mentality is really coming from the so-called intellectual elites, and particularly from the left.
Right.
The left has been incredibly pro-lockdown, which is really extraordinary because the left for the past few months has been telling us that Boris Johnson is a borderline fascist, that he is this horrible, nasty 1930s-style demagogue, and all this other crap that they come out with, which has no basis in reality whatsoever. And then as soon as the virus hit, they were pleading with this supposed fascist to lock us in our homes, prevent people from going outside, shut everything down, which made me think, either they don't really believe he's a fascist and that's all been an act, which I think is pretty unforgivable to use that kind of historical language when it's not appropriate, or they're fascists as well. So I think they've got to make a choice on, you know, which sin they have committed in relation to this. But the left and the media elite and the intellectual elites, I say intellectual, you know what I mean, they're not particularly intellectual anymore.
Right.
They have been incredibly favorable of the lockdown and very haven't given a second thought to the consequences of people losing their jobs, losing their freedom, of the fact that people are probably dying. There is emerging evidence that the lockdown itself is contributing to deaths because fewer people are going to hospital when they're having a cardiac arrest, fewer people are going to hospital when they're having a stroke. And a similar situation I know is happening in the US and Australia too. There was a piece in the New York Times headlined, "Where Have All the Heart Attacks Gone?" And I think what's happening is that the lockdown has sent the message to people, don't be a burden on society, don't be a burden on the health service, and that is having some pretty dire unintended consequences. So I don't think the British people have behaved like sheep. I think they're actually behaving in the way they understand it is this is the socially responsible thing to do. And for a short period of time, we need to sacrifice our freedom for a greater good. Now, it remains to be seen whether that was the right approach. But the people I have most contempt for right now are the upper middle class sections of society who can still work from home, who still get their food delivered to them by Deliveroo guys, who live in comfortable houses with big gardens, and who seem to think the lockdown is some fun experiment, because it's that section of society that is most detached from the idea of freedom and which has no understanding of how ordinary people live and the necessity of work and the necessity of freedom. So it's those people I would most hold to account.
I've been using CBD for about 3 years now, and it's really changed my life. And I've wanted to work with a CBD company as a sponsor on Unregistered for a long time now, but most CBD companies these days are just big corporations that aren't very interesting to me. So I was totally thrilled just last week when Vanessa and Carlos Abelar of San Antonio, Texas approached me about their new company, Paloma Verde CBD. They are exactly the kind of company I want as a sponsor for Unregistered. They're independent, family-owned, and entrepreneurial. Banks wouldn't give them loans or even accounts because they were a marijuana-related business. And Paloma Verde means green dove in Spanish. Why did they choose that name? Because Vanessa and Carlos are both anti-war, pro-peace advocates, which is very near and dear to my heart, as many of you know. Now, I wouldn't have them as a sponsor if their products weren't fantastic, and they are. I love them. I'm a huge fan of their gummies. I just got these yesterday, and they're almost half empty. I also love their soft gels, in particular their melatonin formula. I take two of these every night. It's fantastic for sleep. They also have tinctures, for those who like tinctures. And these days, now that we're all washing our hands way too damn much and getting really dry skin, they have fantastic salves and lotions. Right now, Unregistered listeners can get 25% off everything in the Paloma Verde store by going to palomaverdestore.com and using the discount code RENEGADE. Yeah, that's the class that you have been critical of on a number of issues, correct?
Yes.
You are no fan of the educated class in the United Kingdom. You know, this reminds me of your positions on Brexit. So can we transition to that here? We can certainly go back and forth on the issues, but I think this is actually quite relevant, right?
Right.
These are sort of tightly connected in a couple of ways. For one thing, Brexit finally became official just a few months ago after a long, long, long struggle following the will of the people being expressed in favor of Brexit. It took the educated political class, what was it, 3 years plus to actually finally, truly enact it, something that was enraging to you to the point where you actually called for riots in the street, did you not, on national television? Did you?
Yes, I did. That was a bit of a mistake on my part. Yeah, on the BBC, on one of their flagship political TV shows, I was asked the question because a politician had said, if we don't push through Brexit, there might be riots. And so I was asked if I thought there would be riots, and I said there should be riots. So it was the word "should" that really screwed me over there. People reported me to the police and all sorts of things, and then I was actually quite impressed because the police were responding to people by saying, look, we have to respect someone's freedom of speech and their political speech. So we had a situation where the police were more favourable of freedom of speech than, you know, left-wing journalists and tweeters. So that was quite a funny situation. But, yeah, the Brexit scenario, is in my mind, it was the most horrendous political situation this country has faced for 50 or 100 years. I thought the vote for Brexit was incredibly positive. It was democracy in action. It was a people saying very firmly, it was the largest democratic vote in the history of this country. Mm. And it was people saying very firmly, we want to leave the European Union and take back sovereign national democratic control. That to me is a very positive thing for people to do. Of course, the chattering classes and the political elites went completely berserk because they don't like the idea of national democracy because they think we're all pig ignorant and can't make good decisions. They prefer to do politics in the rarefied chambers of Brussels with people like them, overeducated people, so-called experts, people who share their prejudices, people who share that kind of globalist outlook and have disdain for national democracy and the whole idea of nationhood. So they were horrified that the ordinary people of the UK forced them to take Britain away from the EU and to become a national democracy again. So they tried to stop the vote from going through. I mean, it's hard to explain to non-Brits just how much energy these people devoted to overthrowing the largest democratic vote in history. They devoted financial energy, legal energy, political energy. There were tens of thousands of them on the streets every few months demanding that the vote be stopped. It was an outburst of extraordinary anti-democratic hysteria, of the like of which I don't think we've ever seen in the UK, in fact. So it was a very terrifying situation, and the only time they stopped doing this was when we voted for Boris Johnson to be Prime Minister in the election in December, which was such a stunning victory. The Labour Party was completely trounced. The anti-Brexit wing of politics was completely pushed aside, and the people voted in huge numbers, especially working class communities who normally vote for the Labour Party. They voted in huge numbers for Boris Johnson because he basically said one thing throughout the whole election process, which was get Brexit done. That was the final moment where at last, after 3.5 long years, they accepted the result of the referendum, and they've kind of accepted it now. Although some of them are now trying to use the coronavirus pandemic to say we have to prevent Brexit for the next few months. We have to focus on the virus. And so they're still playing their horrible little games, but they, in the round, they finally accepted that we need to leave the EU.
Wow. So there are three numbers that I think tell the whole story that I've heard you recite many times. So tell the people that these numbers. the percentage of people who voted for Brexit, that's number one, the percentage of members of parliament who supported Brexit, and then the third one is the percentage of Labour Party MPs who voted for Brexit or supported Brexit. Tell them.
So the percentage of people is 52%. That's 17.4 million people.
Yep.
So 52% voted in favour of Brexit. In Parliament, members of Parliament, it's around 30% who voted for Brexit. So a huge difference. And then amongst Labour Party MPs, it's around 5%. So it's such a staggering story of how dislocated the political class is from public opinion, particularly the left-leaning wing of the political class. So the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn presented itself as a party for the many, not the few. It said it was a party of the people once again, and yet this party, 95% of its MPs voted to remain in the European Union, while across the country, the majority of people and mostly working class people who were more likely than middle class people to vote for Brexit. Across the country, the people voted in a completely different way. So I think those percentages tell such an important story about where we're at with politics in this country and the complete and utter dislocation between this overeducated, largely upper middle class, technocratic elite and ordinary people. These two sections of society now think entirely differently on fundamental issues.
It's so nice to talk to British people because they use terms like working class. You know, it's we don't do that over here. You know that, right? Except for the handful of us former left intellectuals in the academies, but otherwise, it's only for you British people. But are there numbers? I mean, I believe this, but you know, I've heard it said many times, as you just said, that Brexit was largely a working class issue. That working class British people were more likely to support it than upper class British people. Do we have any numbers on that to support that?
There are numbers. I don't have them to hand, but yes, I would never call Brexit a working class phenomenon because many middle class people and upper middle class people voted for it. Hmm. Lots of posh people voted for it. It was a mixture of people. But what is really fascinating to me is that by every single indicator, for example, do you own your own home? Have you been to university? Mm. Do you work in a profession or do you work in a trade? All those class indicators demonstrate that the more working class you are, the more likely you are to have voted Brexit. The more upper middle class you are, the more likely you are to have voted Remain. It's very, very clear that there is a class differential. There's also a geographical differential. The major cities mainly voted for Remain, but the rest of the country mainly voted for Brexit. And there's a generational difference, which is really striking, which is that the younger you are, the more likely you are to have voted Remain, and the older you are, the more likely you are to have voted Leave. So it really brought to the surface what had gone unspoken for a long time, which is that there are massive class, generational, geographical differences in relation to politics, social attitudes, views about the nation, views about democracy. So it was one of the most wonderfully clarifying moments in the history of this country, in my view. It really told us an important story about what Britain is thinking at this moment.
So let's break down these differences. I want you to do your best to analyze, perhaps psychoanalyze, these two class formations that you've just sketched out here. You know, I mean, we're generalizing, of course, but you have to do this. So why is it, do you think, that someone who went to Oxford or Cambridge or the University of London and lives in London would be likely, much more likely, I think it's much more likely, right, according to the numbers, to support remaining in the European Union? What is it in that person's head that would lead them to have that to to draw that political conclusion that we must stay in the EU?
Yes. So university education is one of the clearest markers for someone who voted Remain. It's really quite striking. And of course, Remainers say, well, this proves that if you're clever, you are in favor of the European Union, because, you know, they can't help but be completely elitist in relation to ordinary people, many of whom may have left school at the age of 16 or 18, never gone to university, but are, you know, play an incredibly important role in our society. So yes, the university is one of the key indicators, and I think that's absolutely fascinating. And I think it actually reveals how conformist universities have become, because the problem with universities in America and the UK is that over the past few years, they've been doing the opposite of what they should be doing. These ought to be open, free spaces, in, you know, welcoming of intellectual experimentation, welcoming of difficult thinking, welcoming of just an instinct to question everything and to really challenge orthodoxy. But instead, they have become factories of orthodoxy. They've become places in which there's one way to think, and if you don't think like that, you're in trouble. You'll be no platformed, you might be banned, you might be disinvited, and if you're a student, your life will just be made pretty difficult, and you will learn quite quickly to keep your ideas to yourself. So I think universities have really shifted away from their original mission, which was to be, you know, zones of free thinking, and they've become places in which you are educated into the orthodoxies of the establishment. And the orthodoxies of the current establishment are identity politics, you know, wokeness in general, political correctness, the cult of fragility, obsession with race and gender and other identitarian issues, and a love of global institutions like the European Union, and a suspicion of national democracy and a suspicion of national debate and national discussion. So I think lots of people who've been through university have been inculcated with that kind of culture, and as a consequence, they think being pro-EU makes you a good person, and they think being anti-EU makes you borderline a fascist. So
what is it about the EU, the European Union, the idea of it, and maybe the practice of it, that it would appeal to those people with those particular politics? What is it about woke identity, social justice politics that would make one favorable toward an integration of the entire European continent?
I think there are two reasons they feel attached to the EU. The first one is it's quite difficult to explain, but let me put it like this. I never heard any of these people talk about the European Union until Brexit happened. You know, after Brexit, they were marching in the streets, waving the European Union flag. They were crying outside Parliament. You know, they were painting their face blue and gold in the colours of the EU. They went completely mad. And it struck me that that was entirely a reaction against the voices of ordinary people. So that it's not that they had a long-term attachment to the European Union. In fact, I've spoken to many very well-educated Remainers. I've done so many media debates with them over the past 3.5 years. And it's become clear to me that a lot of them don't understand the European Union. They don't understand how it works. They don't know what it has done to Greece. They don't know what it's done to Italy. They don't understand its history or its working. So their attachment to the EU, for the first part, is driven by their revulsion against the idea of democracy, or their revulsion against the idea that the uneducated woman who cleans their offices when they go home should have the same power as them when it comes to determining the fate of the United Kingdom. It's the idea of democracy and the fact that democracy is the great equalizer and gives everyone the same power, i.e. one person, one vote. They really find that a repulsive idea. But then the second reason, for those of them who
are more familiar with the European Union and do understand it. The reason they have an attachment to the EU is simply because they prefer politics to be done in a way that is insulated from public pressure. And the thing about the European Union, I think the thing that's most important to understand about this pooling of sovereignty that has taken place over the past 40 or 50 years is that it has been driven, you know, it's not that there is this evil clique in Brussels that has forced all these nations to bend their knee to the European Union. Mm-hmm. These nations have done this willingly. Mm-hmm. This is national elites who have outsourced their sovereignty to the European Union over a period of 30 or 40 years, it precisely in order to insulate politics from public pressure. And what Brexit represented was a ripping apart of that insulation. It was a tearing down of that insulation in order to create a more direct relationship between people and politics. And so the second blob of people of Romanians who actually do know about the EU, they are actually horrified by the prospect of uninsulated politics and what might now happen in politics, given that people have more direct power than they did previously.
Interesting. Okay. I think there might be even more to it than that, the psychology of the educated elites. That's something I've been studying a lot in the U.S. I mean, they've always been attracted generally as a class, at least in the United States, and in particular those close to foreign policy making, to international integration. And of course, under U.S., you know, total control or domination, but they've always been pushing for things like the EU, you know, in various ways. Things like NATO, right? That was a U.S. idea. Things like the United Nations, that was largely a U.S. idea as well, and on and on. But back to the ostensible concerns of that class in your country. You stated that they are afraid of the woman who cleans office buildings having a voice. Now, hang on. That woman, a woman who cleans office buildings in London, is quite likely to be a Polish immigrant, right? Or something, right? And which is exactly who they claim to be protecting by voting against Brexit, because Brexit was, and I think with some justification, right, was in some part an anti-immigration movement, even though I support it. I, by the way, am for no restrictions on migration among people anywhere. I'm an open borders crazy guy. But I still supported Brexit for many of the reasons that you do. But there's this interesting contradiction perhaps there, right, that they claim, I mean, if your analysis is right, they're afraid of the demos, the ordinary people. In fact, the lowest orders of society having a say, while at the same time claiming to be protecting the lowest orders of some society from racists like Nigel Farage and the people who wanted Brexit to kick out the immigrants, right? Because there was a lot of anti-immigrant discourse in the Brexit movement, correct?
I think it's fair to say that immigration was one of the key issues in the referendum, and it was one of the things that exercised people's minds when they voted for Brexit. But it's fascinating, if you look at the poll of public opinion that was done on the day of the referendum itself, the number one issue that Leave voters gave for voting Leave was that laws that apply to me as a Briton should be made in Britain rather than in Brussels. So the first reason was the classic democratic sovereign belief that we should make our own laws. And then the second reason on the list of things they were thinking about was immigration and the need for tighter border controls or a more focused debate on immigration. So that was definitely in there. I think even to the extent that immigration was a key question, I think even that was related to the broader question of democracy. Because what made people uncomfortable about the European Union is that it really took the issue of immigration away from the democratic sphere. So if you adhere to the single market of the European Union, then you have to accept freedom of movement of people across the European Union. And there are many people in the UK who thought that that was an undemocratic imposition, and in a democracy, people ought to be allowed to take part in a public debate about immigration, what kind of immigrants we need, where they should come from, and so on. So one interesting fact which gets overlooked is that around a third of ethnic minority voters in the UK voted for Brexit because one of their concerns is that what the European Union has done is it has made immigration to the UK white. It's made it a pretty white affair. You know, Europeans have freedom of movement, but it's more difficult for Africans and Indians and others to come to the UK. We have a huge Indian and Pakistani community who have made enormous contributions to our society. Mm-hmm. And the Indian community in particular is incredibly well integrated and incredibly important. And three of the most significant offices of state, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the Home Secretary, and the Attorney General, are currently occupied by people from Indian heritage. Mm. And those kinds of voters were worried about the way in which EU freedom of movement made it more difficult for their family members or their friends to come from other non-European countries. So I don't think it was anti-immigration so much as it was a desire to democratize the discussion about immigration. And it's actually interesting, surveys have found, including European Union surveys, have found that British people have a much more favorable view of immigrants than most other European countries, and that view has grown more favorable over time, including over the past 3 or 4 years. Mm. So it's a complex discussion. I think the view that people are putting forward fundamentally is that every single significant issue in a society should be subject to open, free, democratic debate. And that includes immigration. So I think even there, it was not a racist sentiment. Of course, there are some racists and they're pretty nasty people. Even there, I think the immigration question was bound up with the broader question of who runs this country. Is it me, the person with a vote, or is it people in Brussels over whom I have no direct control?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm still thinking about this sort of desire for transnational integration, right, among the elite classes, which is both here and in the UK, for a long, long time. You know, is it about, I mean, you're stating it as a fear of democracy, right, and a fear in particular of the demos, the people, and their voice of the people. Could it be a little bit deeper than that? Could it be a fear of simply chaos, of the unknown? Right. The more you integrate, the fewer governments we have, at least, you know, theoretically, the more predictable they will be, I suppose. And the more predictable politics will be, and the more predictable the world will be. I mean, I'm just trying to get inside the minds of these people. Like, I don't understand it. I have no need to integrate all of the people into one world government, but, or under one world government is really what it is, right? Under. Could it be that? Is it more than just a fear of poor people having a voice? Go ahead, yeah.
Yes, I think that is part of it, but I think it's closely linked. I think when they think of chaos, they often think of unfettered democratic debate. I think a lot of this actually, in the European context, a lot of this stems from the Second World War, which has, of course, determined every facet of European society for the past 80 years or so. Mm-hmm. And the elites of Europe really drew completely the wrong lesson from the Second World War. The lesson they drew from the Second World War is that mass opinion is problematic. Democracy is problematic,
And if we leave it unchecked, we'll get more Nazis because they are of the mistaken opinion that Nazism was a product of democracy and particularly of working class voters going crazy. Not true at all. In Germany, working class voters were more likely to vote for the middle ground social democratic party. And it was mostly, it was the academic professional middle classes who were most favorable of the Nazis. So their history is wrong. But that's the lesson they drew from the Second World War, and particularly from the experience of the Holocaust, which casts a shadow over modern Europe, was that democracy is a problem. Mass opinion is a problem. And then subsequently, freedom of speech itself could be problematic too. And that's why there's lots of censorship in Europe, particularly in relation to far-right propaganda and Nazi racism and so on, which is censored in many countries. So that's the lesson they drew. And then bit by bit, over time, they developed institutions and laws and treaties that were fundamentally designed to elevate politics more and more above the public sphere. So that you can see that in the way in which the growing role that the judiciary plays in politics, and I know the judiciary plays a growing role in American politics too, the role of the judiciary, the role of judges, the role of quangos, the role of institutions like the European Union, of course, the role of the European Convention on Human Rights, which sounds nice but isn't, all of these globalizing phenomena mm-hmm. were fundamentally designed to offset what they thought was the cause of the horrors of Nazism. And they thought the cause of the horrors of Nazism was stupid, unchecked public opinion. Mm-hmm. And so that's the lesson they drew. It's, in my view, it's completely the wrong lesson. It's completely inaccurate. And it's led to a modern day Europe in which freedom and democracy are very closely guarded and don't enjoy the liberty that they ought to.
So I don't identify as a libertarian for a lot of reasons, but you must be aware that many libertarians, at least in the United States, I don't know about over there, but here are not just critics of democracy, but anti-democracy, right? And I agree with them, but I agree with them even more deeply than they do. Here's why I have a problem with democracy, in particular in this country. It's 350 million people live here. Okay, so it is essentially an empire itself. What on earth, why on earth should the people of Florida and Maine and Seattle and Los Angeles and Kansas City all be under one roof? That looks like an empire. We have every ethnicity. We have people who speak every language. We have every culture in the world represented here. Yet they all are under one flag. They can all be conscripted into the same army at a moment's notice. They're all expected to speak the same language. It's the Roman Empire. I mean, it's just in a modern form, right? Just I'm talking about within the borders of the United States, okay? So why should people in Florida have a say over how people in Maine live? And why should people in Maine have a say over how people in San Diego live? That's number one. Number two is, you know, and this is really going to rub against you wrong probably, but, you know, people, at least in this country, I know the British are known for being better educated and more articulate than we are, and that's somewhat true. But Americans, my God, they're ignorant. My God, they're ignorant, in particular of politics, and in particular of foreign politics. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the polls of Americans' knowledge of the world, but it's beyond dismal. I mean, I think a majority of Americans can't identify, you know, England on a map of the world. I mean, I'm not kidding. I mean, it's really this bad. I mean, there was a they put, where did they put in a recent poll, they put Syria in every corner of the globe. They couldn't find it anywhere. But, you know, I mean, Americans don't, we're not a particularly intellectual people. We're not a particularly learned people. We're not very curious about the outside world. This is historical, by the way, among Americans. And so to give them the power to elect a person who has essentially unchecked power in foreign policy, that's what we've also created. The American people have been so stupid that they have, through their elected representatives in Congress over the last 50 plus years, given the executive unilateral power to blow up the entire world in 5 minutes. You know, and thank God it hasn't happened, but at any moment, and many people said that's what Trump would do, that electing Trump was basically pushing us very close to Armageddon because he's so erratic. I don't think he'll do that, but he's certainly possible. It's certainly in his ability to do that. But God knows who the American people can elect next, right? And that person, again, can go to war, this has been shown over and over again, without congressional approval at any moment. And that kind of war can be even bigger than World War II and Korea and Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan. It could be a total war anywhere. So I don't love the idea, actually, of, and this is not about class. I mean, even upper class Americans are basically just ass ignorant about politics, and I have them, and I certainly don't want them having a say over how I live, in particular if they live 3,000 miles from me and have nothing in common with me and we don't know each other. So I am with you. I agree with you on Brexit, and I support Brexit because of the decentralization of it, that I basically favor decentralization wherever I find it. The more states, the better. The more governments, the better, competing against each other. I'm against nations too, but the more, the better. I'd rather have more nations than one nation. That's why I support the general impetus to break apart and be separate from the rest of Europe, the rest of the continent. But, you know, what do you think of democracy? It sounds like you like it, but is my argument at all, giving you pause, especially in a country of the size of the United States? It's one thing to say that, you know, like, I mean, Britain's fairly large, but, you know, like, it's a hell of a lot smaller. But, you know, in a small country, I would be less afraid of democracy. But in a country this size, or the size of China, or the size of India, but certainly the United States, which I know very well, I don't like it, because Americans have cast many, many votes and elected many people over the years that have wreaked havoc across the globe, and they could do much worse any moment. So there you have it.
Yeah. So what do I think of democracy? I am head over heels in love with the idea of democracy. I think it is the most important and still the most radical political idea mankind has ever come up with. And I'm fascinated by what you say. I've heard some of these arguments made before, and I've heard them made, you know, very convincingly and very honestly. And the first thing I want to say is that I am completely opposed to American intervention anywhere in the world, and massively support national integrity, national sovereignty, and you should not interfere in another state's affairs. That's why I'm opposed to every single foreign venture that America has been engaged in over the past few decades. So I agree with you on that. I don't think people in the question of whether someone in Florida has the right to vote in a way that might impact on someone in New York or anywhere else, that's for Americans to decide whether they want a federal system or a more state-based system. That's for you guys to decide. But it is unquestionable to me that someone in Florida should not have the right to vote in such a way that it would impact on someone in Iran or Syria or Sierra Leone or anywhere else. So that's a question of, I think there is an absolute necessity to rein in the foreign policy establishment in the US. That's why I was a bit of a fan of Tulsi Gabbard in the recent primaries. I thought she was incredibly smart and very, very principled. Mm. She's not against America being active on the international stage, but she is definitely against regime change wars, and I thought that was a positive step forward for a politician to take. But on democracy, I get it. The reason you referred to me as a libertarian earlier, the reason I'm moving, I find myself moving away from that name more and more, is precisely because of the democracy question. So I was fascinated to hear what you said. You're absolutely right that libertarians are not just skeptical of democracy, but anti-democratic. I used to get invited to speak at libertarian events all the time in different parts of the world. And most of those invitations have completely dried up, because at the last 3 or 4 or 5 libertarian events I've spoken at, I've stood up and said, you guys are way too anti-democratic and you need to grow the hell up. So so I've had these clashes, and the point I've tried to make to them, just to, I guess, to boil it down and maybe open up this discussion, the point I've made to them is that I've said to them, I think you are wrong to see a tension or a conflict between freedom and democracy. Because fundamentally what libertarians will say is, I have all these wonderful freedoms, the freedom of speech, the freedom to smoke marijuana, the freedom to own a gun, etc. And I don't want, you know, 3 million voters in some part of the country to have the right to take those freedoms away. So they juxtapose their individual freedom against the collective freedom to determine who runs the country. I think that's completely wrong, because what they end up saying, which strikes me as completely nonsensical, they implicitly end up saying that my freedoms need to be protected by a force that exists above democracy, and that exists above mere mortals like me, because we're all included in society. And they end up arguing in favor of constitutionalism, legalism, and fundamentally state structures, who are the guardians of constitutionalism, of course, who they see as a more trustworthy defender of their individual liberties than the person who lives up the road, or the people who live in Florida, or wherever else it might be. Which, firstly, I think is wrong. I think the elites are always more suspicious of freedom than ordinary people are. So I think it's completely wrong to have that view. And secondly, I think it is such a self-defeating argument, because what they're fundamentally saying is that I love freedom, but no one else does. That's not true. And also, you can convince people to love freedom more through exercising your freedom of speech and through engaging in democratic procedures. So the point I've tried to make to libertarians, with massively varying degrees of success, normally it's been a complete failure, has been to say, listen, the best protector of freedom is people. It is ordinary people who don't have a vested interest in the foreign policy establishment, who don't have a vested interest in gun control, who haven't gone through the university system and come out the other side as these kind of safe space lunatics who think that someone with a penis can be a woman. I mean, talk about stupidity. And who think that all sorts of ideas must be crushed under the boot of diversity or whatever else they're saying. It's not those people we should trust, and those are the people who will become lawyers and constitutionalists and politicians and members of the civil service. It's not those people we should trust. It's ordinary people who don't have a vested interest in that ideology and who do have a vested interest in living freely and having choice. So I really think the best way that libertarians can fortify their freedom is through more and more public engagement and more democratic engagement.
Because the people in particular of the lower classes will tend to agree with them. Is that your point?
I think there is. sometimes they will and sometimes they won't. And that's part and parcel of living in a democratic society. So But the thing is, you know, libertarianism in particular, and I said this at a conference recently, and I'm sure I will never go back, libertarianism tends towards being antisocial. And there's a moment in libertarianism where individualism, and I think individualism is an important idea, and I think individual freedoms are very important, but there's a moment where individualism crosses the line into atomization and a self-regard. And it's almost like their love of individual freedom is driven fundamentally by a social awkwardness and by a desire to force-field themselves against the pressures of life, and you know, and the pressure of convincing other people of their point of view. So it becomes this incredibly luxurious, almost narcissistic ideology, where it's a given. It's a given that I have these freedoms. It's a given that absolutely no one can question them, and leave me alone to do my own thing. And so, you know, that kind of retreat from the world, I think, is incredibly unhealthy for the individual, him or herself. And I think it's incredibly unhealthy for the argument for freedom, which ought to be a living argument. It ought to be an argument that we make every single day. And, you know, going back to your earlier point about, you know, the fundamental difference between America and Britain is that you guys have a constitution which guarantees your freedom and we don't. You know, I think the Bill of Rights, particularly the First Amendment, is such a wonderful thing. But I think it's a blessing and a curse at the same time. It's a blessing because you have it written down that the state may not interfere with your freedom. Brilliant. But it's a curse because it means sometimes that freedom, particularly freedom of speech, is taken for granted. So if it's challenged on campus or in your workplace, you turn to a lawyer, it's very procedurally struck down and your freedom is restored. Whereas I think the good thing about the UK is that freedom is written into our DNA, but it's not written into any form of constitution. So we have to keep making the argument for freedom in a real way that connects with people, otherwise we will fail. It's the point that, you know, there was the American justice Learned Hand made this point, which is that when freedom dies in the hearts and minds of ordinary people, no law or constitution can save it. And I really think libertarians should think about that, because they have fallen for the phony comfort of constitutionalism. Which will only get you so far, because you have to change hearts and minds in order for freedom to become a genuinely lived experience.
Agreed, very much so. The law is nothing without a culture supporting it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
We know that very well. I like to use the example of jaywalking in New York City, right? In New York City, everybody jaywalks. Old ladies jaywalk, children jaywalk, everybody jaywalks. But it is illegal. It is illegal. You can be fined. And if you don't pay the fine, you can actually go to jail. But everyone jaywalks anyway. And so what happens? The police basically don't enforce it. And so the law becomes meaningless because the culture is not upholding that law in any way.
Yeah.
Right now in the United States, and I know you've done a lot of talking about this, the culture in regards to the First Amendment and freedom of speech, I know this has been a major issue for you, I right now, having spent the last 20 plus years in and around college campuses here and seeing that the woke identity politics, social justice, hostility to free expression is now finding its way into Congress. We now have several members of Congress who sound exactly like college freshmen who I used to teach in their skepticism of the First Amendment, because it basically allows white men to say nasty things about brown-skinned people and therefore isn't so great after all. You know, we now have people who are from that that class, that category, that kind of thinking, who actually are members of Congress. And there's going to be more coming, obviously, because we've been training them for decades now. So there's, and I know this because I was there. I mean, I used to teach at Columbia, then I taught at Barnard College, I've taught at Occidental College, I've taught at all these liberal elite schools that have been pumping out these ideas and these people. And they're the ones who will take positions of power, as you said earlier, you know, not just in Congress, but in the media. We're also seeing it also in the media, a hostility to free speech, freedom of expression. In fact, I was just listening to a podcast in which someone from Instagram, I think the head of Instagram, was apologizing. Just that's all he had to do was apologize for allowing improper ideas and thoughts during the election onto their platform, right? Meaning, you know, Russiagate stuff, right? Pro-Trump stuff, whatever, fake news. So I am pessimistic about the future. And again, I'm agreeing with you again here. Like, the First Amendment itself is of less concern to me than the culture of free speech, than the culture, frankly, of curiosity, right? The culture of skepticism, the culture of embracing debate and difference and conflict intellectually. That's what I stand for more than any political position I take. Yeah. That any political position, even maybe on war, that is the one that I will not ever back down on. That's what Renegade University has been built on. That's what we are all about. And so I fear for that, because I see the culture of all those things eroding and eroding and eroding. And now I think even in law, it will begin to disappear. So, but let me get back to democracy. I want to keep coming at you here on democracy. I liked how you said that libertarians need to grow up. I'm about to make an argument in favor of childishness against adulthood. In fact, I was going to write a book called Against Adulthood, and democracy has a lot to do with this. And I also liked your analysis of libertarians. You know, it's true, you know, libertarians are known, I think that's less the case now, but certainly they are known for two things: being very intellectual, they have the highest IQ of all the political ideologies, and just they sort of like socialists. They're very similar to socialists in this way, right? You're a Marxist or a former Marxist, am I right? Yeah, so I mean, same, and I grew up around Marxists. My parents were Marxists. I used to be a Marxist. You know, it's exact same kind of personality, right? The people who live in their head all the time, right? Don't live in their bodies, don't live in the world around them, right? It's partly you and me still. But libertarians are especially known for what you called social awkwardness, right? And it's indisputable. Now, not all of them are like that, but the socially awkward are greatly overrepresented among libertarians. There's no doubt about that. And it's a speculative analysis, but I think it's plausible that that's what leads many of them to be anti-democratic. Because the demos is the social, in a sense, it's a kind of social. All right. That's not bad, but let me tell you this. Before I started hanging out with libertarians, I had a totally different opposition to democracy than theirs. I just added theirs onto mine, so I have two major reasons to be opposed to it. So you're a former Marxist or still a Marxist?
Former is more accurate, fundamentally, because I just think Marxism is a dead ideology. I don't think it's ever coming back. Okay. I sometimes still refer to myself as a Trotskyist because I feel this unshakable favorableness towards Trotsky. I feel this instinct always to defend Trotsky because I think he was just so profoundly intelligent and focused, and he made some wonderful arguments in favor of freedom and in favor of art and in favor of human exploration. And, you know, my rallying cry is really Trotsky's rallying cry. Trotsky said that the aim of a decent revolutionary person should be to increase the power of man over nature and decrease the power of man over man. And that's really sums up my approach to politics. I think we should increase our power over nature, i.e. we should have more industry and growth and production, and you know, the erasure of poverty is very important. And we should decrease the power of man over man. We should have fewer laws that control speech. We should have, I think, the welfarist state should be shrunken because of the way in which it allows the upper middle classes to control working class people. So my outlook really comes from Trotsky's outlook, which is more control over nature, less control over man.
That's absolutely bewildering. I'm sure you've been, I'm sure you've had this response from many people. So Brendan, I don't know if you know this about me, but I was born a Trotskyist. My parents were Trotskyists. They were members of the Young People Socialist League and then the International Socialists, which I think was Christopher Hitchens. He was attached or affiliated with them at some point. Tony Cliff, you know Tony Cliff? That was their guy. So we, like, my parents would actually go to London to meet with the British Trotskyists because that's where there was more Trotskyism going on. And throughout my childhood, I just thought that was proper. That was like being in a church of Trotsky, you know? I mean, that's just how you think, you know? There's nothing to be questioned here. And then I finally got to graduate school and I finally sat down and read The Permanent Revolution by Trotsky. And I also studied Russian history and I studied Soviet history pretty extensively at the London School of Economics, by the way, when I was there in London. That's what I was doing. I majored in Russian and Soviet history. I think Trotsky was an authoritarian mass murderer, frankly, and had nothing to do, no sympathy for freedom whatsoever. I don't know what you're quoting, but that's okay. We can talk about Trotsky maybe on another episode. That's a long discussion to have. I don't know how on earth you can be a fan of Trotsky and hold your politics, but maybe we can figure this out. Let me tell you, this is not so much about Marxism. It's really about socialism. And I assume you also were, or you were a socialist at some point.
I was a communist.
Yeah.
In my youth. I was a communist.
Meaning capital C and member of the Communist Party?
A member, no, not the Communist Party because they were Stalinists, but a member of the Revolutionary Communist Party, which was more Trotskyist.
Okay, so in the UK, the RCP was Trotskyist. You know, here the RCP was Maoist.
Right, yes.
Yes, so, which very confusing.
The RCP, yeah. So the RCP, I mean, this is real People's Front of Judea stuff, but the RCP in the UK was Trotskyist and was incredibly critical of the Soviet Union, of course, and of the official Communist Party in the UK, which was pro-Soviet Union through to the very end, fundamentally. So, yes, we were on the Trotskyist side.
Right, but also socialist, of course, right? Yes, okay. You favored the collectivization of the economy, correct?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and how about this? So, I mean, socialists, including Trotskyists, have, the smart ones anyway, have often argued that, and I think they're right about this, okay? I think they're right about this, that socialism is the fullest expression of democracy because it is the people not just voting in elections for representatives. It's not just people voting on public policy, which is democratic. It is people deciding what is produced, what is distributed, and how it's, and to whom it's distributed, right? And how much wages are and how much prices are and all, right, the direct control. And the more socialist, the more direct control there is of all those decisions, right? You agree with that, that socialism is the fullest expression of democracy?
In a roundabout way, but my issue is that may have been a live discussion 30, 40, 50 years ago, but I think it's increasingly irrelevant because, in my view, socialism is a dying force. Even the Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn phenomena were really just woke
upper middle class politics, and it was it dressed up as socialism. I don't think it was really socialism in any fundamental way. And my concern with the current moment is that it's for the very fundamentals of democracy. So it's not that I'm saying democracy needs to become this all-encompassing force that impacts on every single aspect of life and economic life. It's more that I'm saying that the fundamentals of democracy, which is the right of people to choose their government, the right of people to choose the policies and the laws under which they live, that kind of, I guess you would call it a bourgeois view of democracy, even that is being called into question. And that's the thing that I am concerned to defend, whether it's against, you know, woke elitists in Britain or socially awkward libertarians in America. So I think that's how people have understood socialism, but I have absolutely no doubt in my mind that socialism is not coming back in America or Britain anytime in the near future.
Okay. So going to vote, whether for president or governor or an MP or for or against Brexit, it's not that much work. I mean, I don't mind doing that. I don't vote at all, but it's not like it's because it's onerous. It's because I don't, there's never anything for me to vote for over here. But real democracy, like no bullshit democracy, where, you know, the original democratic thinkers, those who've promoted this originally, the very serious people about democracy, that's not democracy. Democracy is us participating, making decisions, the people, like your immigrant worker in the office buildings, right? The cleaning lady, all of us participating actively in the governance of our society, right? Okay.
Yes.
And
I agree.
Yeah, and the more decisions, it sounds like to you, the more decision making, the more spheres of governance that the people have control over, the better. Is that also your position?
Yes.
Okay. So I am already fucking exhausted just thinking about that. Just thinking about the work that you, Brendan, are asking of me as a democratic small
group. You don't have to do it. And I think every freedom comes with the freedom not to exercise that freedom, right? So we have the freedom of speech. We also have the right to be silent. We have the freedom to vote. We also have the freedom not to vote. I disagree with the Australian system in which voting is compulsory and you can be fined if you don't vote. I think that's wrong. Uh-huh. So you don't have to engage in any of this. But the thing is, you know, on the question of democracy, I think this is such a fundamental sticking point. You know, the great irony is that, you know, right-wing libertarians, as you say, you don't call yourself a libertarian, but right-wing libertarians in places like America, and then kind of, you know, super woke, politically correct leftists in places like the United Kingdom, mm-hmm. they would think of themselves as being polar opposites. They would think of themselves as being, you know, the two most different kinds of people you could get. But they have a shared horror at the idea of democracy. They absolutely do. The right-wing libertarian, socially awkward guy who comes up to me at the end of when I've done a speech and is not very good at making eye contact and is a bit strange and probably a virgin, and that's fine, absolutely fine. You know, I shouldn't be too mean about these people, but they're out there. You know, when they come up to me, they always say, my problem with democracy is blah, blah, blah. When I meet woke leftists on British campuses who have every single politically correct opinion you could imagine, they will say the same thing. They will say, my problem with democracy is you didn't know what you were voting for. You right. read tabloid newspapers and therefore you're unintelligent. You right. don't understand the complexities of how the European Union works. So it's the unifying force between these two sides in the culture wars is a suspicion of democracy. And I think it's really important important to challenge that. I think it's important to challenge that from the point of view that, firstly, the great thing about democracy is that it gives people power they otherwise wouldn't have. And that's, it's great for people like me and you. We have a public platform. We make podcasts like this. We write things. We have a little tiny bit of influence, right? Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. But there are millions and millions of people who don't have that. You talked earlier about being pro-immigration. I'm also pro-immigration. Mm. I am the child of immigrants. I'm a first generation Briton. I'm the first generation of my family ever to live in this country. Mm. So I'm a fresher immigrant than most people in this country. Mm. I know the benefits of immigration. I know that if it wasn't for immigration, I probably wouldn't be talking to you now. So that's all, I agree with all of that. And that's also the thing that makes me more and more inclined towards democracy, because I come from a family that had absolutely no political influence, no ability to express themselves in the public sphere, who have no history, none of them went to university, none of them ever wrote a book, none of them ever appeared on a TV show. Mm-hmm. The only thing they had was the vote. It's literally the only thing they had, and they cleaved to it like a life raft in a world that was absolutely beyond their control. It was the one thing they had, and I completely agree with you that democracy, in your description, it ought to be a more engaged process. And my view of democracy is similar to our view of freedom of speech, because you and I agree that freedom of speech as a legal right is fine, but it has to be a lived experience. It has to be in the culture. It has to be in the hearts and minds. It has to be something you do on a daily basis, not something you have and you can kind of play as a trump card when someone's trying to censor you. It has to be a lived thing. I feel the same about democracy. Democracy ought to be more than voting once every 4 years. It ought to be an attitude, a sense of a state of mind, a belief that I am an equal citizen and I have a real say in this society. And so I think democracy needs to have those similar kind of resuscitation that freedom of speech needs.
But the thing is, I don't want to run society. I don't want to run any part of it. I want to leave that to a political class. I like that there are people who want to run society.
Why? But you don't, but these are awful people.
Oh, no, I put pressure on, no, hold on. I want maximum leverage over them all the time. So
right.
That's why I want to decentralize so they have less power, so they have dominion over a smaller domain, right? I want them to have maximum competition, so I want more political parties. There are never enough political parties competing for me. Okay, and I just think that, and I want to have speech rights like this, so I can talk endlessly forever against them, right? And I want them to fear us all the time. I want, you know, I think term limits are also a good idea. I think there should be more elections, not fewer. I think it should be easier to elect people, not, you know, even though I don't vote, but I'd rather there be more elections, more parties, and smaller sovereignties.
You know who you sound like? You sound like the Chartists. So in the UK, as you all know this, in the UK in the 1840s, there was the movement called the Chartists, who were a group of working class men arguing for the right of working class men to vote, and they were in favor of annual elections. They were in favor of paying members of parliament, because they weren't paid properly then, paying members of parliament a decent wage, because if you didn't pay members of parliament a decent wage, then only rich aristocrats would go into it and not working people. They were in favor of more frequent engagement, more votes, the shrinking of parliamentary power over certain areas of people's lives, but the expansion of people's power over parliament. Mm. So, you know, the thing is, I think my fear in relation to libertarianism in particular is that I think it has forgotten the extent to which the fight for freedom and democracy went hand in hand. And they've cultivated this view over time, over a long time,
that there is this inherent tension between these two things. And if I could say anything to libertarians, it would be to say that the real inherent tension in our society is between a political class which is increasingly suspicious of freedom and increasingly determined to control what we say and what we think, and our right to express ourselves and to organize ourselves. That's the real tension. The role that democracy can play is to come in, give a sucker punch to those political elites, it forced them through public pressure to adhere to the principles of freedom. So I would really genuinely encourage libertarians to see democracy as their friend, but they won't, because they have, unfortunately, gone down this road of anti-democratic ideology, which I think is incredibly harmful to the cause for freedom. And that's primarily why they don't speak to me anymore, because it's just this unbridgeable divide between how they view democracy as a harmful phenomenon and how I view it, which is that it's this wonderful process through which we can expand freedom, expand choice, and expand people's power.
Yeah, democracy to me is not about freedom, it's about responsibility. It's about governing. It's about being the king. It's about the people being the king, people being the governor, right? It's government by the people is the formal definition of it.
Yeah.
Right. I don't want to be a governor, you know. I don't want to govern at all. I don't want to govern other people. So you said that, I mean, it's a funny point. You said that the woke left view of the demos, the ordinary people voting, is the same as many right-wing libertarians' view of that. I don't think you're quite right about that. I think that the problem that the woke left, the modern left, has with the people voting is that they vote in an immoral way. They vote for Donald Trump and they vote for Brexit. They don't know. They are ignorant of what is actually the morally right position to take, right? You agree with that, don't you?
Yeah.
So for me, my problem is not that at all, since I'm basically amoral, for one thing. It is that they don't know anything at all about me, my desires, my needs, yet you want to give them power over me.
And no, I don't want to give them power over you. I want you to exercise your power over government. Mm. That's how I understand democracy. So I think there is this view, that the threat of democracy is the masses will exercise their power over me. They will tell me how I should live. They will tell me what freedoms I can have and what freedoms I can't have. That's not how I view democracy at all. I view democracy as you and me and others collectively. I'm not anti-collective at all, by the way. Collectively expressing our power over the political class, over government, and exerting pressure on government to ensure, ideally, that it doesn't bomb Syria, that it doesn't attack freedom of speech, that it doesn't hike taxes to such an extent that it has a detrimental impact on people's lives. That's how I see democracy. And I think the libertarian view of democracy as this horrible beast kind of breathing down the neck of the individual and telling him, don't do this or don't do that. I think they've confused democracy and government. And they, because governments do things that they don't like and which I don't like, they think that's the fault of democracy. When primarily, for the most part, it's the fault of governments not doing what they've been charged with doing, or running away with their power, or failing to be responsible to the people who voted for them, or responsible in the American context to the constitution of the country. So it's... I would encourage people to have a view of democracy that could see it as possibly the force through which we could exert more pressure for freedom, rather than as a force that is going to force you to do things you don't want to do. You know, it's like if you go back to the revolutions through which America was founded and France was founded, and, you know, in England we did it 150 years before you guys chopped off the king's head and had a revolution and so on. What is so striking to me about those periods in history is that the argument for freedom went hand in hand with the argument for democracy. There was absolutely no contradiction, and it was understood that the freedom to publish and the freedom to speak and the freedom to worship as you saw fit was not contradictory at all with empowering more and more people to have a say in government, because it was trusted that you could convince people through public free debate to use their pressure on government, to use their newfound democratic voice, to pressure the government to respect their freedoms, to respect that their home is a castle, and to respect their right to live as they saw fit and to worship as they saw fit. It's only later than that that we started to get this idea that there is this inherent tension between freedom and democracy. And all I'm saying is I would like to get back to that period in which we saw them as complementary forces.
Okay. Liz, I'm going to talk a little bit about freedom more generally. I've been reading Spiked for a while. I've been reading your stuff for quite a while. I can't remember much on this, but I feel like you guys have been generally on my side on cultural freedom. Maybe not, though. I want to probe you on this a bit. So how do you feel about the freedom to watch TV? How do you feel about the freedom to do drugs? How do you feel about the freedom to be sexually promiscuous? How do you feel about ribald comedy that is simply about entertainment and fun? How do you feel about fun?
Oh, I am massively in favor of fun and hugely in favor of the right to be offensive. And one of the things that Spike thinks is very important is the right to be offensive. We've argued over the years that there's no right not to be offended. So all these people going around saying this thing offended me and therefore I want it to be extinguished are behaving like tin pot dictators who think that they deserve their own personal blasphemy law to protect them from offense. So I'm hugely in favor of the right to be offensive. I'm hugely in favor of freedom of speech as an absolute, in fact. On the other issues you talk about, people should watch TV as much as they want. They should have sex as much as they want with as many people as they want. And I believe in the freedom of people to choose to take drugs. I think we should decriminalize all drugs. But the only thing I would add to some of those discussions is that I think it's still legitimate to argue for the freedom to do these things while also defending the right to judge these things. And another issue I have with some fields of libertarianism is that they veer sometimes towards relativism. So there seems to be this belief that they should have all these freedoms and there should be no judgment of what they do. But so my view on drugs, it's a bad idea to do drugs. I think if you're seeking a synthetic high, there might be something wrong in your life. I don't think it's something we should encourage, but I think absolutely people should have the freedom to do it. The government should not have the right to tell people what they can ingest into their bodies. And this is a fundamental principle of the Enlightenment. If you go all the way back to John Locke, John Locke wrote a letter about tolerance in the 1600s, which in many ways is the beginning of Enlightenment thought, or certainly kind of propelled it into its new direction. Mm-hmm. And in that, he talks about the bounds of government action. He says, what should be the restrictions on the right of government? And he goes so far as to say, he says the government should protect our property and it should protect us from being harmed by other people. So if someone beats us up, then, you know, that's the government's business to a certain extent. But he says that the government should not have the right to stop us from harming ourselves. And then, of course, this idea was developed even further by John Stuart Mill, who talked about the harm principle. And if you harm someone else physically, that's a legitimate point at which the government can intervene and say, listen, stop what you're doing. But if you harm yourself, for example, by over-drinking, that should not be the government's business. So this is a fundamental principle of, you know, 400 years of Enlightenment thought, which is that there are some areas of life where we do need a government to intervene, to arrest the person who broke into our house or to prevent someone from killing someone else. These are things government all needs to do. But when it comes to the choices we make, even choices that we think are wrong, even choices that might be unhealthy, I believe in self-government. It ought to be the right of the individual to choose for him or herself what TV shows to watch, what comedy to laugh at, what racist language to use, and what drugs to take. And then the rest of us can say, that's good or that's bad. But the freedom has to lie with the individual.
John Locke also wrote a book about education, the education of children. And in that book, do you know what he said about dancing? He wrote quite a bit about dancing in that book, devoted a considerable section of that book to dancing. Do you know what he said about dancing?
No, what did he say?
Children should be taught not to dance because it's frivolous and it takes them away. It's individualistic. It takes them away from their responsibilities, makes them lazy, etc. Now, you know who else railed against dancing? Not just dancing, but drinking, fornication, loose sexuality, all the things we've been talking about, the founding fathers of the United States of America.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is in my book, Renegade History of the United States. It's the first chapter. All of them, to a man, denounced those things, even though they were hypocrites in many cases, but whatever. Yeah. Publicly, they were all against the kinds of libertine freedoms that you and I have been talking about.
Yeah.
Now they had a very brilliant argument, actually, about this, especially John Adams, which they all, and they took this from Locke, which had to do with, guess what, Brendan, democracy. So their argument, which I think is actually a very smart argument, I just happen to be on a different side of what they value. We have different values. Their argument is that if people are fornicating and drinking and gambling and dancing, they're not going to be thinking about how to run society. They're not going to be reading the newspaper and learning and finding out what's going on in politics, which is what is required in democracy. We need a disciplined people if we're going to hand them the power of government. We want the governors to know what they're doing and to focus. I want them to focus their entire life on it, right? I want them to not be distracted even by a glass of beer, you know? I want them to not be thinking about sex. I want them to be thinking about the stoplights and who should be the dog catcher and who, whether or not we should have open borders and all the, you know. And so they went on a moral shaming campaign immediately after the revolution, immediately after the War of Independence. And they wrote books about this, you know, went on and on about it. So I think there's a tension between you saying that people should be allowed to do whatever they want and you saying people should be democratic.
But the thing is, I mean, you know, I'm not a Puritan by any stretch of the imagination, but I recognize the incredibly important role that Puritanism played in propelling us into the more liberal democratic era we currently live in. So Puritans played an incredibly important role in the English Revolution too. You know, these were pretty stiff people. You know, they didn't like Christmas very much. Mm-hmm. They weren't particularly fond of drinking all day long and so on and so forth. But it was driven similarly by a kind of slightly paternalistic view that in order for the citizenry to take itself seriously, it needed to focus more and it should not go down the road of alcoholism or promiscuity and so on. So that was there absolutely unquestionably in the early period of the societies we live in. That was there and it played an important role. the thing is, I wouldn't be overly judgmental of that. I mean, it's not a view necessarily that I share, but it did have an incredibly important influence on certain communities. You know, in the English context, for example, the Civil War in England from 1652 to 1651 is still really casts a shadow over the whole of this country. You know, a whole entire territories are still defined by which side they took in the Civil War, whether it was the side of the monarchy or the parliamentarians. And even if you look at the vote for Brexit, in parts of the Black Country and the Midlands and other parts of the country that voted for Brexit, a lot of them were the parts of the country that were most pro-Parliament in the Civil War and which had that history of a kind of Puritan, democratic sense of seriousness. So we've benefited from some of this stuff. That's what I would say. Whether I would have made the same arguments if I'd been around at that time is a different question entirely. But I think the thing is, I think there's a problem with describing freedom as the right to do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. It's not that I disagree that freedom means the right to do whatever you want, but I think it reduces freedom to this frivolous, hyper-individuated, almost narcissistic exercise. Whereas which is fine. If people want to do that, that's fine. If people want to stay at home all day taking drugs and having sex with people, that's absolutely fine. I would not encourage any legal restriction on their right to do that. Mm-hmm. But I think it would be legitimate for other people to say, that's a shameful way to behave. That's an embarrassing way to behave, and you should take yourself more seriously and engage in your community or do something more useful. So I think that the point I would try to make, which I think some of these historic figures were probably trying to make, is that you should not lose yourself in freedom to such an extent that you lose control over yourself. And the idea of self-government, as the name suggests, is that not only should you have the freedom to think and the freedom to speak and the freedom to make up your own mind, that's the most important freedom in my view, your mind should not be made up for you by someone else. That is the starting point of tyranny. You should have all those freedoms, but also contained within the idea of self-government is the idea of self-control, is the idea of a willingness to engage with others, and it's the idea of, you know, being a pretty serious person who wants to make a contribution to society. If people don't want to do that, absolutely fine. But I do think it's worth encouraging people to do that if they can.
Okay. So let me just finish with these two closing points. You can respond. So the Puritans, a lot of people don't know this, but they were puritanical in the ways we know them to be puritanical. They were opposed to drinking and sex and dancing and all the rest of it. They were also quite democratic. And in fact, the Puritan church, the Calvinist churches operated very democratically and in fact allowed women to be ministers in some cases, Anne Hutchinson being just a very famous example of that. But it has been said by many, many scholars of American history that, and I agree with them, that democracy came from the Puritans as an idea. The founding fathers were influenced by John Locke, certainly, but they were also very much influenced by Puritans, and they all said this. And the idea of democracy is actually more clearly expressed in the Puritan churches than it is in John Locke. And so I say that that is not a coincidence. In fact, I have said for many years that democracy is puritanical, not because it's evil, but because it requires so much repression. It requires repression to govern society. It requires repression, as I said, of one's pleasures and desires and freedoms, individual freedoms, to do the kind of work that you want us all to do, which is to read the newspaper and watch cable news every single day and follow Twitter so we know what's going on and so we can make decisions about the whole world for everybody else. Number two, and I'll let you respond and then we can close with that. Number two, I have heard you not just now, but in the past make the claim make arguments on behalf of more what I would call moral absolutism or more just moralism, right? So I've heard you say that, you know, for instance, it should be said that the burqa is a terrible thing that women wear, right? That it should, that is a bad thing. We should say that it is bad in many ways, morally and otherwise. And you're also saying here that we should have, we should also moralize against people for drinking and fornicating and all the rest of it, right? Now, if you were to just leave it at that, I suppose I'd be okay with it. But you must know that the kinds of imperialist wars that you and I hate equally, I think, have always been justified, and I would say have always started, in fact, with moralistic absolutist claims like the ones you just made. So especially, and people can understand this quite readily, I imagine, with the burqa example, right? I mean, that was one of the primary justifications for the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, was to free the women of the Middle East from the burqa, right? This was Hillary Clinton's whole argument for why we should invade and conquer those countries. It's been one of, it was one of the main arguments of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. They said these things. They said, you know, it is immoral that women are forced to wear the burqa, when, by the way, they're not actually, I mean, many of them choose to do this, and when asked, they support Sharia law. But anyway, that has been, you know, right? That's to me where imperialism starts. Now, it doesn't, to make a moral claim about other people doesn't necessarily lead you to wanting the tanks to roll in. Like that would be Brendan O'Neill, right? You make moral absolutist claims about people around the world, but you also are opposed to the tanks rolling in. You're also basically an anti-imperialist, it sounds like, right?
Yeah.
So, but I mean, isn't there somewhat of a danger there in making moral claims about people who live halfway across the world who you'll never meet, and by doing so supporting the actual military imperialists, the political imperialists who you hate so much?
I don't think there is. Just to take your two points, the first one on the necessity of repression in a democratic atmosphere, I don't really accept that. I think you're absolutely right to talk about the important role that Puritans played in propelling us into a more democratic era. I think that's incredibly important. And absolutely fascinating historically and so on. But I would say self-repression is not necessarily a bad thing. It can be, right? Self-censorship can be a really bad thing. And John Stuart Mill, you talked earlier on incredibly well about the necessity of the culture of freedom, the culture of skepticism, mm-hmm. a culture which implicitly encourages people to think for themselves and to question what they are told. I completely agree with that. And John Stuart Mill wrote very well in On Liberty about the way in which often the tyranny of conformism or the tyranny of wisdom, supposedly, can be a greater barrier to freedom of speech than actual legal censorship. So I think that's a really important point for Americans in particular to remember, because the First Amendment only guards you against state intervention into the realm of freedom of speech. It doesn't guard you against the culture of censorship, which says, listen, don't say that thing that you think because you will hurt someone. So the culture of freedom, I think, is absolutely important. Self-censorship is an incredibly destructive force because it's usually brought on by this overwhelming sense of pressure to conform, and that's very negative. But self-repression, repression of one's instincts, is not necessarily a bad thing. If your instinct is to sit at home all day masturbating and drinking cans of lager, that's not good. And I'm more than happy to say to those people, this is not a good way to, you know, this is a moral judgment. I'm going to make a moral judgment. That's a bad way to spend your life. you should repress your instincts to do those things and see if you can be a more engaged, free, positive citizens. So that's the first thing I would say. Repression of one's instincts. I mean, actually, I'd go even further. Repression of one's instincts is in some ways the beginnings of civilization itself.
This is what Freud said. That's exactly right? What Freud's argument was. Yes, civilization in its sense. That's the argument. Yeah, that's right.
So, but censorship of one's views is a problem. So that's what I'd say on that. And then on your second point, which is so interesting, and this in itself will be another podcast, on moral judgment and moralism and Burke and so on. I mean, firstly, I would make a distinction between moralism and morality. Moralism is usually the weaponization of the moral view to the end of forcing or shaming other people or forcing them to do what you think is best.
Nice.
Moralism is a pretty destructive force. Mm. Morality, on the other hand, can be a very positive force. Moral code or a moral view or a moral sense, particularly if it's one that's derived from open discussion and open debate and community engagement, can actually be an incredibly useful thing in people's lives. On the burqa, which I think is a really good example to raise, the point I've made about the burqa is that I absolutely defend women's right to wear it in the UK, because some Western European countries have banned women from wearing it, which I think is horrific, and an attack on freedom of religion, and actually makes these women's lives harder, because if they believe they can't go outside without the burqa, then a ban will just mean that they don't go outside, right? Their lives become completely miserable. So I'm completely against a ban, but I'm in favor of people having the right to judge the wearing of the burqa, to say it's wrong to cover your face in public, it's antisocial, it's anti-democratic, it makes people feel alienated from you, and it's very possible you're being pressured to do this by the patriarchal community that you come from. So I think it's really important to distinguish between banning something and judging something. Banning things is almost always a terrible, terrible idea. Judging things can be a very useful exercise. And the point I would make, I guess, to finish on, I think tolerance is an incredibly important value. But tolerance, what it means to me is it means being a free-spirited individual who is so favorable of freedom that he is willing to tolerate even things he doesn't like, even practices he doesn't understand, and even religions he thinks are bizarre. So I am more than happy to tolerate women wearing the burqa. But tolerance doesn't mean suppressing your own moral view. It doesn't mean censoring your own judgment. It doesn't mean being a relativist who thinks all cultures are equally valid. So I said earlier that freedom and democracy are not contradictory forces. I would also say that freedom and judgment are not contradictory forces. Everyone should have the freedom to think and live as they see fit. And everyone else should have the freedom to judge them or to say, I disagree with what you're doing. The problem arises when either a mob or the state uses power that they ought not to have to force people to live in a different way. And that's the tipping point that we have to be incredibly sensitive to. And that's the moment at which people like us should say, no, stop, you don't have the right to put pressure on this person to change what they think or what they do.
Yeah. Well, so I would say about 65% of what you say and your politics, I enthusiastically agree with, and the rest I disagree with. But what a great object lesson we have just provided here, right? Because for me, this has been like going to Disneyland. You know, this has been just great fun. It's all been intellectual and political, but it's been tremendous fun. And I've learned a lot from it. And my mind has had to grapple with things in the course of this conversation that it hasn't in a while. So I really appreciate that from you. The other thing I realized I forgot to say at the beginning, I usually would say something like this at the beginning. You are one of my very favorite journalists in the world.
Oh, thank you.
And Spiked is one of my very favorite media outlets in the world.
Thank you.
And I mean, I have never not really enjoyed your columns. I have never not enjoyed your talks. And Spiked too, all the writers at Spiked. I read Spiked on a regular basis. I have for years. I strongly recommend it. Doesn't matter if you're American, you will see these are issues that certainly Americans can relate to. And the way you guys think is just so outside the box. You know, you don't fit, as we've been talking about, you don't fit, even though you're called libertarians, you clearly don't fit into, you know, the libertarian box. My God, you know, Trotskyism and Marxism. I mean, what is this all about? You know, it on the surface, it seems almost ludicrous, but actually read Spiked, read Brendan, you will see there's a coherence to the thought that is invigorating and unique. And also, you're also brilliant writers because you're British, I guess. So everyone should read Brendan and read Spiked. And thank you so much for coming on. This has just been a complete blast for me.
Oh, thank you. This has been one of the best workouts my brain has had in a long time. So thank you very, very much for that.
That's what we do here. It's all about, well, it's all about, you know, the strong democratic man, you know, and you got to go out and you got to go run society. So you got to be like well-trained. All right, man. Thank you very much, Brendan. And I hope to see you very soon.
Thank you. Cheers.
All right. Cheers.
This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To experience the new Renegade University, go to renegadeuniversity.com. Thanks for listening.